morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu. Welcome.
Oh, there we go. You're going to be so different this morning. You're drying up before we even began.
Oh, I'm tired. So
is that what it is?
Yes. Okay. Anyhow, it's Ann and Peter Haig as usual. And today's program, I would say we talk a lot about sensible food.
We do.
Yes.
And we have a lot of sensible food in this program. And we're scooping the Today Show. This program, I don't think the famous Mark Bittman of Stage and Screen has been on Today Show talking about his new cookbook yet.
I don't know that. I wouldn't be able to say that.
But we caught up with him talking about food matters.
Mark Bittman, you are a household word in our household. We sent our son off to college with How to Cook Everything, followed by How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. And now we have you here talking about your latest book, The Food Matters Cookbook. Well, you look really fit when you're on the Today Show, so I think that that's a good advertisement for your philosophy. Could you briefly just lay the groundwork for the cookbook by telling us, in case somebody's missed the Food Matters book, where you lay out your premise and your philosophy, what that's about?
Yeah, of course I can, although it's pretty much reiterated in the cookbook. But there's a very basic principle here, and the principle is one of being more reliant on plant food than we have been. That is, on vegetables, fruits, nuts, legumes, and less reliant on whole grains, and less reliant on animal products, processed food, and junk food. We've grown into a society that thinks that meat is a staple. We eat half a pound of meat a day, and as a result, meat is being produced industrially in horrible conditions, as everybody knows, in unbelievable quantities, as most people know, and it's not good for our personal health. It's not good for the planet's health.
Now, you had a bit of an epiphany about that, didn't you, that really started you on this track?
Well, what started me on this track was I got started in more intellectual fashion, which is that I could see that this was the way things had gone, and I could see what I thought was the writing on the wall. But personally, yes, when I turned 57, which is now almost 4 years ago, I suddenly had lost my bloom of youth and was a little heavier than I should have been. My cholesterol was a little higher than it should have been. My blood sugar was higher than it should have been, and so on. And I thought, well, the way to fix all this stuff is to sort of put my money where my mouth is and start eating a more plant-heavy diet. So I adopted this diet whereby I eat pretty much as a strict vegan would from morning until evening, and then I have a dinner that's pretty much the same kind of dinner I've always had, which is to say, totally omnivorous. And it worked. I lost a lot of weight. My cholesterol levels went down, my blood sugar levels went down, and for a 61-year-old, I'm pretty healthy.
Now, for those who want to research this even more, you wrote a book, we might call it a manifesto, called Food Matters.
Well, yes. We just said that, yeah, but he repeats some of that in his cookbook, of course. Mark, you said that of all these cookbooks, you've written a lot of cookbooks, this one was the hardest one to write, and you also said that you were trying to create a new American style of cooking and eating. Now, why is this the hardest? Because it's really on trend now, and it makes the most sense.
Well, I'm glad you think it's on trend, and I'm glad you think it makes the most sense, but to do a book like How to Cook Everything, where basically you're re-exploring the classic, is not the most creative thing in the world. I did it in my style, and obviously it took a great deal of research and a great deal of work, but Food Matters Cookbook is really a new style of cooking, and a lot of people don't cook this way, which is to say with much less meat, with fewer animal products in general, with no processed foods. And that is not the traditional American way of cooking, and I felt very often like I was really reinventing things.
Uh-huh. Now, you call it sane eating. And I have to tell you, from being a lifelong high-protein gal, I started doing this a while back, too, with vegetables.
Well, it is the sane way to eat, and it's also the traditional way to eat. I mean, it's only in the last 60 or 70 years that we in the United States and people in Western Europe have had the opportunity to eat pretty much meat as we wanted to. But that is not the way to keep ourselves healthy. It's certainly not the way to keep the planet healthy, and it's unsustainable. And people are, I think people are interested in sustainability. The Food Matters way of eating is a sustainable way of eating. The typical American way of eating that we've all grown accustomed to, and say since the end of World War II, is completely unsustainable. And to the extent that it spreads around the world, it's going to make things more difficult, not less.
I remember, Mark, when I first came to the United States in 1972, and I was in Indiana, and I ordered a prime rib dinner at a restaurant, and the The prime rib shape, of course, was triangular, and on a very large round plate, it overlapped the plate on all three corners. And I said to myself, my goodness, what a country this is. This piece of meat would have fed my family for a whole meal, and that was five of us.
Well, it is quite a country, and it was fun while it lasted, but as I said, it's not sustainable, it's not practical, it's not healthy, and, you know, that's exactly what should happen, is a prime rib from a steakhouse in the Midwest should feed five people. That would be perfect, actually.
Now, let's ask what might seem like a silly question for someone who's already written enormous books with lots and lots of recipes, and you said you really had to start over with this one. How do you manage to create this many recipes in a reasonable period of time in order to get them into a book?
Well, I work hard. At this point, I have help. I have people thinking with me and talking with me and working with me, and all I can say is what I do.
Yeah, and you cook a lot. I mean, things evolve.
I do cook a lot, but sadly I don't cook as much as I used to because I travel a lot now also. But still, when I'm home, I cook. I mean, that's the thing.
Now, the good news from your book, I think, is that you don't recommend that everybody just changes immediately. You think that you can do this as an aggregate of small changes?
Well, thank you for pointing that out, Ann. I think if we could snap our fingers and all become vegan tomorrow, that would be a very interesting and probably desirable result. But that is not going to happen, and to suggest that it could is idiotic. Similarly, people have trouble making changes. We all know that. But even a 10% change in our diet as a nation would be significant, which means that a 10% change in individuals' diets is significant. And a 10% change, assuming you eat 21 meals a week, that is 3 meals a day for 7 days, changing 2 meals from meat-based meals to not meat-based meals is a 10% change in your diet. And I think that for many people, is a significant change. And I also think that will show people that it's not that big a deal. It's not that much of a sacrifice. There is food beyond processed food and animal-based food that's enjoyable. We all know that. And I think that's a step in the right direction.
See, it's easy, I think, to eat seasonally, for example. Summertime has been wonderful. We have heirloom tomatoes in the garden. It's our garden, or it's the local farmer's market. It gets really tough here in December and January in southwestern Pennsylvania.
Well, it does get more difficult, but there are plenty, you know, whole grains don't go out of season, beans don't go out of season. We have plenty of vegetables and fruits from nearby states that are around all year. So to suggest that one has to switch to an all-meat diet or a meat-heavy diet in the winter is really not, it's not a suggestion that really carries much weight.
But now, shopping, I think, has become tough. I mean, I don't think it's as easy as it used to be because there's so many lies on all the labels.
Well, the thing is that if anything is labeled as healthy, it probably isn't. So you're right. There are so many lies on all the labels, which is why the easiest and most sensible thing to do is ignore all of them and buy food that you know happens to be food. I mean, real food doesn't really have very many ingredients. Real food doesn't have to be labeled with any nutritional information. Real food is just food.
Well, you list, by the way, pantry, what the basic pantry, and then you also have an advanced pantry, which I looked at and I thought, I need to add some things here.
The thing is that you can get, I remember I used to live in New Haven when my kids were young, and I remember driving all over town to find olive oil and soy sauce and ginger and even scallions. And now, you know, obviously every supermarket has all of those things. They're easy to find. And what used to be considered a very exotic pantry is now a pretty common pantry.
Yeah.
Jacques Pepin, we talked to him once, and he said when he first came to this country, he said you couldn't find mushrooms anywhere. You couldn't even find button mushrooms that were fresh.
Right.
And as an indication of how much has changed, a tremendous range of varieties of that wonderful food substance and lots of other things too. So there are more things available. But what you're saying is that the transformation that's needed is for people to take advantage of that. Against that backdrop, it's really disappointing that the aisle which has the most variety in the supermarket is the cereal aisle, but it's all sweetness.
The most variety, it may have the most boxes, but
it's a lot of boxes. That's what I meant.
Our family visiting from overseas always comments on the cereal aisle. They can't even believe it.
Well, sadly, it's going to get to look like that.
Exactly, over there.
Things are going.
Now, can I pick your brain 1 minute on something totally? Ginger, you use a lot of fresh ginger. How do you keep it? Do you freeze it?
If you freeze it, it gets watery.
You just buy small amounts.
I do buy small amounts, and you can always break a piece off. So I keep it in the refrigerator, and it's good for a couple of weeks.
Uh-huh. Now, I think that I happen to love beans and pulses and things like that.
Then you've got a great head start.
Yeah, but your pasta dishes are wonderful. Do you want to mention just a couple of those?
I won't stop you.
Why don't you pick a couple?
Oh, do I want to mention a couple of those? Well, I particularly love pasta with greens of any kind. So pasta
with broccoli rabe,
and you can add a little sausage to that. So pasta with broccoli rabe and sausage is quite wonderful. I do love pasta with chickpeas. I like pasta with beans in general. Pasta with chickpeas in particular.
You had one that I thought was odd, called ZT with silky cabbage, oranges, and chickpeas.
Yeah, well, that cabbage cooked that way, it gets very tender and stays very moist. It's delicious. And I just love chickpeas in anything.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, you had a comment about beans that said, all my recipes call for preparing beans the right way, starting with dried ones, but you can work. No, it's almost as good to use beans out of a can.
Look, I wouldn't stop. I'd rather cook beans, but I work at home, so I have probably more time than most people do. And one morning a week, usually, I take a pound of beans and throw them in a pot, and I mind them during the course of the morning, and then I have them. But if people want to use canned beans because they're short on time, there's certainly no harm in that.
So you sort of create a stock of beans to use for a few days out?
Yeah, I cook a pot of beans every week, and I cook a pot or two of whole grains every week, and I just keep them in the fridge and use them as I need them.
Now tell me this, do you know the kind of person they hire to put just a couple little rocks in all the dried black beans?
That doesn't happen quite as much as it used to.
I thought that was so funny. My recipe came from a Cuban, and it says sift through for stones. Sure enough, every single batch I had one in.
Because you have to be careful if you're at restaurant Mugaritz outside San Sebastian, because he cooks potatoes with rocks, and they look the same.
That's funny.
So you have to bite carefully into the dish. But the potatoes are actually cooked by the hot rocks.
That sounds nice, yeah.
Now, I think that we should, something you do in this book, I think we should mention for people who are tiptoeing into this whole scenario, you stress flexibility and you give a lot of options for substitutions and so forth in these recipes and even cooking techniques.
I've always thought that being less specific was more helpful to people than being more specific. I don't like to say you must use this. I was looking at a magazine the other day, and they had four recipes on one page, and three of those four recipes had vinegar, and each of those three recipes had a different kind of vinegar, without mentioning that they were virtually interchangeable. And I think that really does people a disservice. I think that what you have to say is, here is how you cook this dish. If you don't have A, you can certainly use B. If you don't have C, you can certainly use D. And on down the line, so that people begin to understand that cooking is really just the assembly of ingredients and that it's very hard to make mistakes, as long as you stay within the realm of common sense and as long as you have some of the basics, a grasp of some of the basics. Get super specific, I don't think does anybody any good.
If you're a fan of sherry vinegar.
I love sherry vinegar.
But you like rice vinegar, too. I like it, too. Rice wine vinegar.
I like it also. Yeah, it's very mild, actually.
Yeah. We just found a wonderful... where is he from? South Africa.
Yeah, he's from Stellenbosch in South Africa. And they said they made vinegar by mistake one year. Their winemaking didn't work. And their entire wine product turned into vinegar, but they had this great idea that they would rescue the harvest by selling it as vinegar instead.
Oh, it's good stuff. You could drink it, yeah.
And now that's probably the more important side of their business, although I'm sure the volume is still in wine. And the gentleman who started that is now living in Arizona. I never did quite understand why he was in Arizona.
I don't either.
Right.
But if you're going to South Africa anytime, what's the guy's name?
I can't remember.
You can't remember. But if you happen to be going there, we'll get you the information. Now, I have a question because, like all of your books, this is a little awe-inspiring in terms of its size. Now, how to cook everything and how to cook everything vegetarian, a usable, at least to me,
and I think our son uses it the same way. You can, if you don't know quite what to cook for dinner, you can think of an ingredient, or perhaps you already have an ingredient, you look it up in the wonderful index, and lo and behold, you have three or four ways you can use this ingredient. Now, can you use Food Matters Mo's cookbook? Can you use that the same way?
He has an index.
I was just asking him the question.
He has another index, which I didn't quite understand, about where to find fast recipes and things like that.
There are great lists in the book, and it is organized a lot in much the same way as How to Cook Everything. I think people will be able to find how to use ingredients that they buy and be able to find variations very easily. And I spend a lot of time on, frankly, a lot of money on indexing, and the original How to Cook Everything, the great thing about it, I think, was the lists that showed people how to do things in different ways, and that has become something of a trademark, and yeah, I intend to carry it through in every book that I do. I think that it's funny that Food Matters Cookbook, which is 500 recipes, a fairly substantial book, is considered small by my standards, but it's a pretty big book, and there's a lot in there, and as I said at the beginning of the interview, I think it rep an interesting department. I think that it's the last word on this.
Well, basically, I think everybody, this is a book for a new era, and how we eat, and I think everybody should rush out and buy the Food Matters Cookbook, and I hope you have a wonderful time when you're in Pittsburgh.
I'm sure I will, and sorry I'm going to miss you, and thanks for everything.
Will you be able to go to the Dinosaur Museum?
I don't know what the schedule's like yet.
I suspect they'll have you fairly tied up.
Yeah. I would imagine.
So, but anyhow, thanks for talking to us, and have a great tour as well.
Okay, thanks for having me. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
And we're going to take a break right now, but on the other side of the break, come back for more Mark Bittman and the Pittsburgh Connection.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, listeners. We promised you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and this is Peter, not Ann, just in case you were wondering. And why am I doing this segment? I'm really not sure why, except that I wanted to continue to link Mark Bittman with Pittsburgh, because 2 days from now, on the 28th of September, Mark is going to be in town, and Chef Andrew Morrison, who we interviewed very recently, is going to be cooking selected dishes from this cookbook at the Fairmont Hotel in a wonderful dining room there, and you still have a chance to go there. There's an announcement about how to find that information on the menu news, and I think it would be fun to take advantage of the opportunity to go there, to meet Andrew, to taste some of Mark's cooking, and to talk to one of the country's leading food personalities. So why don't you do that? And in the meantime, here's the interview we recorded just recently with Andrew about what else he's cooking up at Habitat at the Fairmont Hotel in Pittsburgh.
Well, it's really funny. We just did an interview with a cookbook author from England, and now we have a chef from England, but I was quick to say to the lady we spoke to just a little bit ago that in spite of the National Health Service and my mother's cooking, I made it to my majority, and now here we are. The world of British cuisine has changed so much. We're now importing British chefs as fast as our little legs will carry us.
Right.
And we have Andrew Morrison, the new executive chef at Habitat at the Fairmont Hotel, as the latest example of that. Andrew,
which is a very smart hotel, I must say, Andrew. You must be happy working there, and it's a great little restaurant.
But let's first of all say thank you very much for coming to our city. We're grateful you're here. Welcome, even though you're from a part of England that really doesn't belong, called Lancashire. You're allowed to say something back about Yorkshiremen if you like.
Yeah, actually I'm from Cheshire, so I don't even get into the whole War of the Roses thing. We're over that.
We're all over that. We love Chester, by the way.
Yeah, that's a great town.
We had a lovely time. We had a lovely stay at the Grosvenor Hotel, and the chef there cooked a really nice dinner for us, and it's quite a remarkable city. And,
it is, yeah. There's a lot of old Roman ruins there, and the town is still built around the old Roman walls.
But let's get back to chefing. Chefing isn't necessarily something the kids from Cheshire grow up wanting to do.
Yeah.
So what happened?
Well, I suppose you're right in a way, but at the time when I was a teenager living in Cheshire, I got an opportunity to start working in a restaurant, and I didn't really plan to become a chef at that point. I just had a job, and I was probably, you know, 16 years old or something, washing dishes and peeling potatoes, and the work became more intense, and I enjoyed it, and I sort of continued to do it, and I moved around for a couple of restaurants and found myself enjoying the work more and more and taking it more seriously until things just sort of progressed naturally.
So you sort of, the bug got you. Now, you remember Chris Horridge?
Yes.
We had, he was a chef you may not have run across. He was at Bath Priory, and then he was at Cliveden. But he said he started cooking because he couldn't find a job, so he joined the Air Force, but he really didn't want to fight. So he signed up to learn how to be a cook.
Oh, okay.
And it became a very fine one, just as you did as well. Now, did you actually go to cooking school?
No, I didn't go to a culinary school. I did not. I just, as I said, I just started working in restaurants and just continued to work in restaurants. And I graduated from the School of Hard Knocks, as they say.
That's right. It.
Now, you've cooked around at various properties, haven't you?
Yes. Well, prior to being here in Pittsburgh, I was with the Four Seasons, and I was with them in both Atlanta and Miami. Prior to that, I was in New York for many years. And I've also spent some time in Seattle, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles.
Wow.
So, yeah, I've moved around quite a lot.
Exactly. So how did you sneak in here? Were you like Daniel Ballou? You came on a tourist visa?
Yeah, I did originally, yeah, but that was a long time ago. That was my first experience of coming to America, was I came to Los Angeles on a vacation.
And then you just never left, huh?
Basically, yeah. I mean, I did leave for a little bit and came back, but yeah, basically that was the start of being here in America.
Now, you've had some interesting experiences. Do you keep up with the chefs on a national level a lot?
Keep up how? I mean, I definitely try to stay current. I read a lot of, you know, internet stuff, and I read people's menus online all the time. I'm always looking at other new restaurant openings and things like that. I do, yeah.
Okay. And, I mean, do you have buddies?
Do I have buddies?
Friends,
that's
pals.
That's an American term.
Yeah.
What is the English term?
Pals.
Pals.
Yeah, pals.
Friends.
Yeah, of course I have friends. I have other chef friends in other cities around the country, of course, and yeah, I keep in touch with them, and we do some sort of networking and especially finding products and things like that if they find something that they think I'd be interested in, or vice versa.
But now your philosophy is you try to use as much local product as possible, huh?
We do, yeah, we do here at the hotel. And, you know, being in Pennsylvania is actually working out very well for us, especially at this time of year, because there's an abundance of local products for us to play with.
What are some of the good products you've discovered?
Well, I'm getting this trout at the moment, which I'm really happy with. I get beef from Pennsylvania, I get trout, I get...
Is that trout, the farm trout?
It's a farm-raised trout, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good product. I've known that for a long time.
Yeah, really high-quality fish. We get local mushrooms, I've got lettuces, I've got just an absolute abundance of produce.
You have squash because you were serving that wonderful little squash soup the other night.
Yeah, that's right. We do get all our squashes. We're going to start getting pumpkins fairly soon. We just finished with squash blossoms that were coming in. But, yeah, squashes are big.
Yeah, the friend of ours who came in, I remember I mentioned to you, a friend of ours came in to dinner and he said he thought your stuffed zucchini flowers were just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, they're a great dish. And we fill them with crab meat and we serve them with a fresh heirloom tomato gazpacho, which is basically just crushed tomato juice. It's delicious.
What about your, I mean, we've already said now, you're into sustainability big time and natural big time, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and you were talking about Mark Bittman, who's going to be launching his book tour, his new book called The Food Matters Cookbook from Habitat. And you're friends with him, and in fact, you sort of have similar philosophies about eating. I mean, you're cutting back on animal protein and emphasizing more plants. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. There is a difference between, like, in my personal life, when I'm eating at home or stuff, I definitely try to eat less meat and more vegetables.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to do that, too. I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
Eric Repair is a practicing Buddhist.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes. Yes.
I think it must let him eat fish, though.
I don't know. I'm not really up on what they can eat, but thought it was vegetarian.
Wasn't it Michael Pollan who said eat less and mostly greens?
Yes, exactly.
Eat real food.
Mostly
plants, not too much. I think he could have saved himself the work of a whole entire book. Just with that one sentence.
Yeah, he summed it up nicely.
Exactly. So, but run through this new autumn menu you have. And we didn't say when Bittman's going to launch his book tour.
He will be here on the 28th this month. Yeah, and we're doing a tasting menu with him, and it's a multi-course tasting menu, and all the recipes are dishes that are from his book.
Uh-huh. Now, quickly, Andrew, the website where people can find out more and book to go to that?
You can go to the Habitat website.
Right.
Which is?
There's more information there. The web address is... I think it's just, I don't know what it is.
It's www.fairmont.com.
Fairmont, there's a link on the Fairmont website to Habitat. Habitat actually has its own website too. It's www.habitatrestaurant.com.
I wanted to start to say, we came for a tasting of your new autumn menu. Can you run through some of the dishes?
Sure, yeah. We're going to be releasing the autumn menu at the end of this month. There are some great items featured on there. We're going to be doing a mushroom tart, which is it's a little tart shell filled with some braised leeks, and then it's topped off with some roasted local mushrooms.
Delicious. I grabbed several of those.
Did I get
the other night?
Then?
Yeah, I brought you at least one.
Oh, okay.
I ate all the others.
We're going to be doing a risotto with pumpkin and duck confit.
That sounds good.
Yeah, we're going to be bringing in some venison as well. Hopefully, we're still trying to source the local venison. And there's going to be a great scallop dish on there with some apple and parsnips. And we're just trying to bring in more and more local and seasonal products.
Now, whose chicken do you use?
Right now, we are using chicken from Eichner's Farm.
That's local.
Now, the scallops are from Pennsylvania waters, of course.
The scallops? No, unfortunately. Well, fortunately, they're not. No, they're from Georges Bank.
They were really terrific.
Yeah. I try to make a point with all my suppliers of making sure that they understand that we want the best products available.
These are almost the size of a hockey puck.
Yeah, we do get big ones, and really it's more about the quality of the product than anything. And I just try to, you know, I don't mind paying for the quality, just make sure we always get the best product. And you know, some of my suppliers ship to some of the best restaurants in New York as well, and I make a point of letting them know that that's the kind of quality product that I want, is the stuff that goes to New York. Just because we're in little Pittsburgh over here doesn't mean that we shouldn't be getting the same quality product that they're sending into big restaurants in the city. So
did you get on the 4-story farms list yet?
No.
Stop.
It's worth thinking quiet. She raises her chickens and pigs and things like 12 at a time and feeds them exotic things, but they really are quite brilliant.
I don't think we use that one. Is that a local farm? I'll definitely look into it.
She's up near Bradford, Pennsylvania. I think you'd have to Google 4 as in the number, story,
farms. What's that chicken with the blue feet? We had one of those.
Yeah,
the chef gave us one of those. Yeah. Habitat has this open kitchen, so you can watch all the chefs doing what they do, right?
Correct, yeah.
And that's exciting. And you have a chef's table. Is that the table that we were talking about?
Yeah, so there's a large, we call it the communal table. It's a large table right in front of the open kitchen. And I think the original concept for this table was a place where single people, single hotel guests or diners could sit. You may sit a few different couples at the table, so you may be eating with people that you don't necessarily know at the beginning of your meal, but you may end up friends by the end of it. We also book it, obviously, for larger groups. I think it sits 12 people in total.
And you also, you have a pastry chef, Naomi Gallego, and she's supposed to be really great, isn't she? She's competing in this World Chocolate Masters National Selection.
That's right. She's going down to Vegas at the end of this month to compete in the chocolate competition there. And yeah, she's very passionate about her chocolate, and she does a lot of great chocolate work. We actually have one of her chocolate sculptures on display in the restaurant at the moment.
It's tricky stuff. I wrote a chef cookbook, and the pastry chef guy was really into this chocolate and spun sugar, and I couldn't make head or tail out of it. I don't deal that with that stuff at all. So you have a schedule of events. They're keeping you pretty busy.
Yeah, this is a busy month.
And you really moved into the community itself, and you're participating in the community, as is your wife, by the way. She's working on the school lunch idea, isn't she?
That's right, yeah.
But you're doing, I mean, I'm looking at this, I don't know how you're managing it. You're doing the Farmers at the Firehouse Farmers Market. Oh, you did that one already. September 19th, the Flavors of Pittsburgh, which benefits the American Liver Foundation.
Right.
Then you have this Bittman Tasting Dinner. You're doing a cooking class at Crate.
Yeah.
It just goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I'm doing another one on Saturday, actually. This Saturday, there's the Downtown Block Party, where we'll be doing some food there as well this Saturday.
No, that would be fun. We won't be here.
By the time this airs, that'll already be gone.
Okay.
It's tomorrow on the calendar, but a few days ago according to On the Menu program time.
So what should people expect with service-wise when they get to Habitat?
Well, we try and build Habitat as being a friendly place where people can come for dinner. We try to serve really high-quality food, but we try to keep the price points reasonable. We try to just make it a place where people can come and have great food, have a great meal, and know that they've enjoyed some of the finest local products that we can find.
And you yourself are enjoying being here. I think you live on the north side, I think, your wife
That's
said?
Right, yeah, we live on the north shore.
So he doesn't waste time on a commute. I mean, you've become a part of the community already, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. I live within 2 miles of the hotel, so I can cycle into work every day. It's very convenient.
Oh, you cycle too. You really are serious into fitness, aren't you?
Not really. It's actually faster for me to ride my bike to work than it is for me to drive. So, and I don't have to pay for parking. So
I'm sure that's true. Plus you get a little bit of good exercise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
Isn't the hotel a wonderful building?
It is. It's a fantastic.
Was I talking to you or was I talking to your general manager? And I said, were you here before the building started to be built, and did you see what Market Street and Fifth Avenue used to look like?
Right.
Was that you or was it the GM?
Probably the GM. I wasn't here then. There was already a building here when I arrived, but I have seen pictures.
But it was just such an eyesore of a corner, and now it's so dramatically clean. The lobby of the hotel is exciting. The bar and the restaurant is all very exciting. This is really vibrant. There isn't hotel space in Pittsburgh that has anywhere near the energy that Fairmont has brought. So we're just absolutely delighted that you're here as a whole gang of the hotel, but we're even more excited that you're here with another fine dining option, which we can always do with more of.
Right. Thank you very much. Now, yeah, it's a great hotel. I mean, I think everyone's very excited to be here, and that probably shows.
Oh, I just noticed Taddeo Arimoto carved the communal table.
Yes.
Oh, he's done all the great sushi bars in town, you know.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. He's really talented.
Yeah, if you want to see a lot of his work in one place, go to Sushi Kim.
Okay.
14th and Penn. He built that out a little bit at a time as Mr. Kim had the money to do it. But all the work, the cabinetry, the quality of the carpentry is... He's absolutely incredible.
Wow. Okay, great. Good tip.
He was actually a guest on the menu.
Yeah, he was, but I can't remember why.
I interviewed him because I was down there interviewing Mr. Kim.
Oh, that's right.
And I said, Taddeo, why didn't you record something too? You just do such a great work, which he does.
Yeah, it's a great table. It's a beautiful
table. Well, okay, Andrew. It's good as always to talk to you, and look forward to seeing you sometime soon.
Yes, I'm looking forward to having you in for dinner some night.
That would be great.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you. And now it's time for another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Back now, and with more sensible ruminations on food.
rumination. Oh, yeah, we're definitely ruminating about food today.
But this time, we have a lady, Myra Goodman, who's going to bring her particular brand of easy, good, solid food and healthful as well.
And she and her husband operate a business called Earthbound Farms.
Yes.
And lots and lots of wonderful ideas about how to use the produce that they create and people like them create, and a great accompanying book to Mark Bittman's Food Matters, for that matter.
Yes. On the Menu is talking to Myra Goodman. Welcome, Myra. We missed, I guess, your first book called Food to Live By, so you've been at this for a while. Your current book is called Earthbound Cook, and it's 250 recipes for delicious food and a healthy planet. So you are healthful, eco-friendly, and what else? I mean, you do everything, even growing your own food, right?
I do. I don't grow all my own food, but I love to garden. I love having some of my ingredients come from my garden. And I wouldn't say that every single thing that I do is always perfectly eco-friendly, but I strive towards that. I enjoy my food more when I know that it was produced and prepared in ways that are gentle on the environment and more humane to the animals.
And all through this book, which I might say the recipes are just so delicious looking, I'm really hungry, you have little tips on preparing kale, for example, or little eco-friendly things about food miles and why they're important. And did I say you also would make them cleaner?
Well, and also why they're deceptive, why food miles are deceptive. Because my essay, I talk about how people really oversimplify food miles as being one of the most important yardsticks about the ecological footprint of the food they eat, and that in a lot of ways that's not accurate.
Do you know, they just, who was it, just wrote a big piece on that, and it caused quite a flutter on Twitter. Demon. But I thought his argument was full of holes, too.
It's just very oversimplified. I don't know if you want to spend time getting into that issue, but I do have an essay on that in my cookbook. And what I tried to do with the cookbook is I say that it's really three resources in one. So it's a big book. It doesn't look so big, but it's over 400 pages, and it has the 250 recipes, full color, lots of photos of the prepared foods. But it's also two different types of reference books. One is it really tries to address a lot of the eco issues surrounding the food choices that we have to make in terms of sustainable seafood, what's the best meat to buy, why organic is so important, and then it also talks about things you can do in your kitchen when you're preparing food to live more lightly on the environment in terms of conserving water and conserving energy, choosing...
That you said it was better to load the dishwasher full instead of hand washing because you use less water.
Exactly, especially with the Energy Star dishwashers, and all the current ones are pretty much Energy Star where they're very efficient with their water and their electricity use. But yes, if you run your dishwasher full or pretty full versus hand washing, you save a lot of time, a lot of water, and a lot of energy. And a lot of people think, oh, I'm being really good, I'm not using my dishwasher. So I thought that was an interesting little fact. Another interesting little fact is that using your garbage disposal is very intensive.
I'm just looking at this little essay that you wrote about that, because every time I use the garbage disposal, I feel guilty.
My little essay is about how I, when I was younger and I was visiting my husband's aunt and uncle in Florida, she was so adamant, his aunt, about putting everything down the garbage disposal that could go down the garbage disposal, and I always thought, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do, because her husband had a trash collecting company, and I thought she must be an expert in waste disposal. And so for 25 years, I've been constantly using my garbage disposal, so I felt I was so upset and surprised when I heard that they're really very, very hard on the environment.
Oh, it's awful. I feel guilty every time I come
around. So you already knew that.
Well, yeah, I was raised by a mother who was organically inspired and composted everything, and we used black cast iron. I still have all the black cast iron things.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I have a whole life history of this all this stuff that's now sort of trendy and popular. But I got hooked on the garbage disposal when we had cats, and I never knew what to do with the leftover cat food. Where do you put it? You don't put it in your compost heap, do you?
Right, but that's what composting, I think composting is one of those things that's really hard for people to do because it takes time and you have to have space, but composting is such a great ecological act to keep all of that food waste out of the landfill it decomposes anaerobically and then releases all this methane, which is 21 times more potent a greenhouse gas than CO2. A lot of people don't know that.
This is where there's all the problems with cows, right? Cows releasing
cows
methane.
Cows release a lot of methane. That's why, and that's another thing that's really interesting is that all, in terms of the environmental impact, all meat really isn't created equal. Beef has a much bigger footprint than pork products and chicken products. And then how it's produced, if it's grass-fed, it's much better. There's a lot of benefits for choosing organically produced meats. So I think why my book is unique is that the Earthbound Cook really tries to present these wonderful recipes that make you want to get cooking. And then when you're cooking, you really have control over the ingredients you're choosing. And so throughout the chapters, you have all of this information woven through so that you can learn a little bit about it. So if you're going to make my coconut crusted salmon, which is one of my favorite recipes.
I was going to ask you about that one.
So
actually.
Easy and quick, then you can go, oh, okay, wild caught Alaskan salmon, that's a really good choice. Or I could also do the Coho farm salmon, which is an exception to a lot of farm fish that actually is okay for the environment. So I try and help people kind of navigate the ingredients as well as the recipes.
It's interesting. We have wild Alaskan salmon for dinner tonight. I was looking at your recipes and trying to figure out which one to make. But I wanted to point out something else which is deep into the book, and that's I love my electric kettle.
Yeah, and we do too.
And we love our electric kettle. In fact, we boil the water to cook the vegetables in the electric kettle, and then put it in boiling hot.
Because it's so much more economical.
It's also quicker.
That's a great eco tip. I saw the statistics of what percentage of people, when I was researching this, so this is a couple years back, so I can't quote them, but it was what percentage of people in England, in Britain, use electric kettles, and the percentage in America. So few of us in this country, in the United States, use an electric kettle, and once you start using it, you just don't ever want to have one of those stovetop kettles around anymore.
Well, most people here don't even know this product even exists, whereas in England, where they make lots and lots of tea, it's very important to have an electric kettle you can boil up at a moment's notice.
But your mother used to use it with Brussels sprouts.
I actually got the idea from her. It's one of the few culinary secrets that my mother imparted to me.
Not a great cook,
She only did it because it was quicker.
Right.
So that she could turn the Brussels sprouts into mush much more quickly.
Right. But I did here. I'm going to try and find it in my book because I did. I did a race between my, and I have a nice big gas stove.
I saw the section. You said it took 4.5 minutes in the electric kettle and 7.5 minutes on the stovetop.
Yeah, 7.75 minutes on the stovetop.
And if it was on an electric stovetop, it probably would have been 10 minutes.
Right, so it probably averages about half the time. And then if it's half the time, it's half the energy. And the other thing is that those electric tea kettles, they just click off when the water's boiled, whereas when we have it on the stove, it's whistling through the house, the power's still on, the gas is still going, I've got the hood going, so we have all this extra boiling time that was completely unnecessary.
Now, how did you get to the point of being this kind of cook and this kind of advocate for sort of green eating and cleaning and all that stuff?
Well, it's a very unlikely story because I actually was raised in New York City and with absolutely no connection to my food, hardly ever eating fresh food. My mother raised me and my sister on TV dinners, and when we were older, it was Chinese food takeout. And so I never had that connection, and I think there was part of me that didn't know I was missing it, but really felt like I was missing something. And then I came out to California for college, and my soon-to-be husband and I had this opportunity after college to live on this little farm in Carmel Valley for free in exchange for doing some improvements, and we supported ourselves by farming the raspberries that were on the farm. And so that was just a huge wake-up call to me. We saw all the chemicals. It was a conventional farm that were used on the raspberries, and I never realized when you go in your supermarket and you buy food, you don't know what chemicals were used to grow them. You don't see them or taste them or smell them, but when you're the farmer that's handling them, it's very obvious. And so we started teaching ourselves how to farm organically, and then we started teaching ourselves how to cook with the bounty of the farm. And it was so amazing to me. And I think part of my motivation for writing this book is that there's so many people in America and all over, you know, I mean, I think our country really more than other countries that are they've really lost their food traditions, and they don't cook a lot. They don't cook a lot from scratch. They rely on convenience food and takeout food. And so I just really want to share my enthusiasm for the joys of cooking, for getting your hands covered with flour, for going shopping and picking out your ingredients, that it really grounds you in your life to have that connection to the food that you cook and you eat.
I'm sure you're absolutely right. Now, this is a hot trend. So there are quite a lot of cookbooks and quite a lot of opinion books written about this return to traditional farm-to-table seasonal. How do you see your contribution as being different than some of those?
Well, I have not seen a book that has, I mean, for me, that the joys of eating seasonally is one of hundreds of essays in my book. I haven't seen a book that has a lot of recipes, that has all of that ecological content to have people navigate everything from eco labels for coffee to how to save aluminum foil to how to mix your own green cleaners for your countertops.
I got it. So you're saying
it's
more than just a book. It's sort of an integrated lifestyle, an approach to the whole concept of living.
It's a resource book as well as a cookbook. And then it also has, because I think so many people are afraid in the kitchen to try different things and different techniques, and that's one of the reasons why they don't cook, it's also has so many reference points, like reference essays. Like it tells you how to mash potatoes, how to fry an egg, how to cut herbs. So that someone who really hasn't been cooking very long or regularly really feels unintimidated, like they can navigate these recipes.
Yeah, no, I think it's a splendid example of this whole lifestyle. And I think you do such a good job integrating it and spreading the word that you're achieving all kinds of recognition. And I was most impressed. You were on the Oprah Winfrey program, and you're going to be a special on Bon Appetit in February. And you just get one award after another, right?
Oh, well, that's so sweet. We've had some acknowledgement of, you know, our company, Earthbound Farm, has really done a lot in terms of showing that it's possible to farm organically on a large scale. You know, our company, just every year, we have 150 farmers that all together farm on 35,000 acres, and we avoid the use of more than 11 million pounds of synthetic chemicals every year.
Wow.
And we've switched all of our packaging, all of the little plastic tubs for our salads, to 100% post-consumer recycled plastic. So we're creating a market for those recycled water bottles, and all of our cardboard is post-consumer recycled, saving, you know, hundreds of thousands of trees. So I think you know, a lot of that acknowledgement has really come from the philosophy of our company, that we really it's not just our farming, but everything we do, we try and be aware of our long-term impact and mitigate that as much as possible.
Now, are you still on the farm that you worked in 1984?
I'm sitting right now in my den on my house. Yes, we still live on the same property. We thought it was just going to be a little one-year hiatus before graduate school or whatever we did, but we fell in love with this lifestyle and somehow, not intentionally, built a very big business around organic produce and organic specialty salads, and we're still here.
And what a handsome family you have, too.
Oh, thank you.
Your daughter is named after what I think to be one of the best restaurants in New York City, Maria.
Well, you know, that's funny. The restaurant must be named after her because she's almost 21. But I haven't eaten there yet, and that is on
wonderful.
The top of my list. Is it wonderful?
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful, yes.
I was going to go last week when I was in New York, and then I wasn't able to. I had to go to a cookbook party for my cookbook someplace else, which was wonderful.
No, we went on in what would probably be considered the most uninspired meal of the week, which was a just-started Sunday brunch, and even the Sunday brunch menu was just really absolutely terrific.
Oh, I can't wait to try it. Next time I go to New York, I will not let that opportunity pass.
No, you definitely should not do that. And there's another place just across Columbus Circle called Arvoce, which is pretty good too.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah.
Now we should pay tribute before we go, since I'm the husband around this partnership. You say your husband Drew has a very discriminating palate. Now I don't. I rely on Anne, but you rely on him.
I did in my acknowledgments let everyone know that he is my secret weapon. He is really incredible. I mean, because this cookbook was actually a collaboration between me and two other chefs, and so we all contributed our own recipes and then improved each other's recipes. It was a really nice process. But we would have recipes come in, and I'd have my two chefs that I work with, Sarah and Pam, always give me the ingredient list so that I would know what was in there. They didn't have to write out the whole recipe when we were testing in the beginning. And my husband would say, you know, it tastes like there's a little clove in here. And I'd be like, no, honey, look, here's the list. There's no clove. It must be cinnamon. It must be something else. And then I would say to one of the chefs, Drew says that there's some clove. Oh, yeah, I didn't write it down. It was just a hint. You know, and everything. He'd be like, this would be really good if it just had a little bit more cumin. I mean, it was amazing. So I really do credit a lot of these recipes.
Well, wait,
being as good as they are.
Well, way to go, Drew. Now, so listeners, just to sum this up, this isn't just a cookbook. This is a resource book all about how to live more responsibly and more enjoyably by living closer to the land and knowing where what you eat comes from and knowing how to put it together in absolutely delicious ways.
And delicious is emphasized that too. It's not just eco-friendly. It's the recipes are just amazing. Every time I look through it, I find something else that's arresting.
Well, who would make tomato soup with short ribs in it? This is clearly someone who realizes that flavor is very important too. So Myra, thank you so much for joining us on the menu today, and we wish you continued success, and we'll hope to read more of your adventures in the future.
Well, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to chat with you, and I hope to get the opportunity to do so again.
That would be wonderful. Just keep us posted, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mara.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. That was such a pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Okay, and stay with us now while we take another short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and this time we're going to be finding out how to get the biggest bang of high flavor for the least effort.
Yeah, so it's yet another fascinating combination, and with these three cookbooks, you'll find your palate is revived, your larder is revived, you'll be sustainable, you'll be
fit,
all of the above, and at the same time, you'll be able to have a little bit of fun and be able to get food on the table faster.
Well, we're talking to J.M. Hirsch, author of High Flavor, Low Labor. And J.M., a lot of people, really important people, like your book. I mean, I read these testimonials. You've got Paula Deen, Rachel Ray, Jamie Oliver. Who else? Lots of other people.
Right. And thank you, by the way, for having me on. And I do consider myself very lucky to have people so highly of what I've done. And obviously, my book means a lot to me, and I've worked very hard at it to try to bring a kind of a real way of cooking for real life and put it together as a book, and I'm just thrilled that so many people have enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, it's subtitled Reinventing Weeknight Cooking.
Yeah,
right.
So there's a core concept here based on your life experience.
Absolutely. You know, my theory and my book is all about using high-flavor ingredients to make our cooking faster, easier, and tastier. Because for me, if we start with ingredients that taste great before we put them in the pot, we don't have to work as hard for them to taste great when they come out. And these are ingredients like balsamic vinegar and feta cheese and jalapeno peppers and most of everything in our spice cabinet. And if we use these ingredients to kind of inflate and amplify the flavors in the foods we already cook, we don't have to work as hard for them to taste great. And that's what my book is all about, because I just don't have the time to fuss over dinner. I call myself just a dorky dad. I'm an editor. I'm not a chef. I've never worked in a restaurant. I have a crazy life, taking care of my son and working my day job. And at the end of the day, I still want great food on the table. But I just don't have a whole lot of time to put into that.
Now, it's really sort of amazing that nobody did it quite this way before. Now, there are shortcut cookbooks.
Right. You know, and I think people have done this, because I think people naturally gravitate to high-flavor ingredients. We love savory foods. We love sweet foods. We love a spicy or an acidic marinade or dressing. We gravitate to these foods. And I wish I could say it was a brainstorm on my part to come up with this brilliant idea. But really, all I did one day is, because I'm the food editor for the Associated Press as my day job, and as part of that job, I have to develop recipes. So one day, I sat down a few years ago, and I just started thinking about and looking at the recipes I had developed over the years, and my goal was simply to see if there were any common threads so that I don't repeat myself. And I very quickly realized that all of my recipes gravitate to these high-flavor ingredients. And then I started thinking, well, why do I do that? And then it dawned on me because, one, I don't know any better, and two, I don't have time to do it any differently.
You call it blunt force cooking.
Right. And exactly. I mean, that's kind of what I call it, because these flavors are going to kind of bash you over the head. I don't have time for nuance or for subtle flavors. I want food that I'm going to stand to and go, wow. And that's, to me, that's what I want in my dinner plate. And I don't want to just, chicken again. You know, plenty of people have that experience, or just another bowl of pasta. I want pasta that I'm really going to enjoy, with really spiced with balsamic vinegar, maybe some crisp prosciutto, or, you know, take it in another direction and add some jalapenos, or throw some curry powder and coconut milk in there. And there's so many different directions you can go in with high flavor ingredients. You can accommodate whatever your tastes are, whatever ethnicity you prefer in your cuisine, in any direction, but still keeping it very easy and, at the end of the day, really flavorful and fast.
Now, you've got a philosophy on page
V, little I, little I, little I. And but then you go beyond that to explain some techniques that people are going to use in the book, things that, so you're aiming at least at the possibility of someone who didn't cook nearly as well as you do when you started preparing this book.
Well, I still don't consider myself to be a great cook. I'm just, like I said, I'm a dad who cooks at the end of the day. And if I don't know any fancy techniques. You know, I've never been to culinary school. I have learned over the years through trial and error certain things that we can all do that don't add any extra effort to what we're doing, but that can kind of enhance our cooking. You know, and a good example of that is like blooming our spices. Which basically all it means is you throw some fat in the pan, be it olive oil or vegetable oil or butter, and then whatever seasonings you're going to use in the dish, throw those in and heat them for about 30 seconds. That simple step is going to draw out so much more flavor from your seasoning and then go on to build whatever you're going to do with the dish, whether you're throwing in some pasta, or brown some meat, or build a chili out of it.
So that's blooming. I never I'd heard of blooming before. Braising I'd heard of before. Blooming I hadn't.
I don't know why, you cook.
I do. I bloom without realizing that that's what I'm doing.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the thing. These are not fancy skills or techniques. It's something we can all do.
You had a good example of how you pump up the flavor. Just taking a basic ham and cheese sandwich. Do you want to run through that?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's so many ways to do it. I mean, the most obvious is to, instead of using, you know, deli-sized ham, throw some prosciutto in there. I mean, that's going to amplify the flavor so much. But then if you don't want to just use, like, a cheddar or other, you know, more common cheese, you could use, say, a Parmesan, certainly with the prosciutto, or you could use a manchego, would be delicious, an aged gouda would be great. And that's a great start. Just right there, all you've done is substitute two ingredients. You've added no extra effort, and you've changed the whole flavor of the sandwich. But you could also take it a step further. If you're going to go back to maybe use some cheddar, make some extra sharp cheddar with some prosciutto, and maybe slather on some mango chutney, and it's going to give you, or some fig jam. Go back and use prosciutto and Parmesan and a little bit of fig preserves or fig jam. It's going to give you so much more flavor for the same effort of making a grilled cheese or a ham and cheese.
Well, now you were a very funny guy as well. I'm expecting that in your job that you probably have mastered the wordsmanship like you have, but I laughed particularly out loud about Father's Garden. you recount that?
Yeah, my father, my whole family has always been obsessive about food, my family, my parents were foodies before the term was coined, and I grew up eating Thai food before Thai was hot. And, you know, so we had a very broad palate. Traditional Thanksgiving dinner is spanakopita. We didn't usually have turkey. And so anyway, my father, being obsessive compulsive about food, wanted to grow the perfect tomato. But at the time we lived in a house in the city, we didn't have a big yard to grow anything in. And so he decided to get into hydroponic gardening. And
could
so
I read your headline for this little section? Fertilizer, water, industrial grade aluminum foil, sex toys.
So my father encased our basement in foil, rigged up lighting that approximated the wattage of the sun in our basement, and then set up a hydroponic gardening system, grow the tomatoes in our basement. And in order, of course, for tomatoes to grow, they need to be pollinated. And so in order to do that, shy of bringing in a hive of bees into our basement, he got a vibrator. And he went downstairs into the basement, and he worked his way through the tomatoes and did the job for the bees. I never understood as a child why he wouldn't let me help. It seems like a fun thing to do, but only later did I realize it.
So you were raised vegetarian?
I was. My mother had been vegetarian since before I was born, and she remained vegan, actually. And I was vegetarian and vegan on and off throughout my life, and I was raised in a household where meat was certainly available, but it wasn't the focus of our meals.
And we're back to that point now in our culinary lives.
Exactly, it's true. But, you know, over the years, I travel a lot, and to me, one of the greatest joys of travel is to experience the culture through the food. And so when I would travel, I would eat broadly, whether I was vegan or not, I would eat whatever was presented to me. And you know, over the years, it just became more attractive to keep doing that. Even when I got home, you know, I'd go to Italy and I'd have some great meat, and then I'd come home and say, hey, I can get that here. It was really tasty. And so it was just kind of a gradual process. Mom is still vegan, and I still appreciate vegan and vegetarian food, but it's not the way I choose to eat now.
Now, what, if you can just point out a couple of your really favorite recipes from this book, sort of to illustrate the kind of thing your writing is about.
What, one of my favorites is like the chicken mole, which is, you know, a Mexican dish, and it's just a one-pot chicken dinner, and you saute some onions with some oil and some seasonings, and you throw in some cocoa powder and some chili powder, and it's another spicy dish. You can make it as mild or as spicy as you like. And you throw in some almond butter, which is peanut butter made from almonds, and you throw it all together with some chicken that's been chopped up, and you simmer it, and it just creates this thick, rich, amazingly good sauce, savory sauce. It's not sweet at all, even though it has cocoa powder in it. And you serve that over rice or with flour tortillas, and it's unbelievably good. Yeah, I think it has some crushed tomatoes in there as well. And it's on the table in about, I think it's 25 minutes. And it's so simple, and it's so easy, and it's so flavorful. And my son loves it. And that, to me, is a perfect high flavor dish. It's a one-pot meal, and it's incredible. And, you know, another one, I just made it last night, actually, is my shortcut pasta carbonara. My son loves carbonara. And I use whatever deli meat I happen to have on hand. And whether it's ham or turkey breast, whatever I've got, I throw it in the pan, throw some garlic in there, throw a little bit of olive oil in there. If I have it, I'll throw in some smoked paprika, and I brown and crisp the meat. Then I boil up some pasta, throw the pasta in there, stir it all around, throw a little bit of cheese in there, whatever I've got. Last night I used mozzarella and cheddar. Sometimes I use Parmesan, sour cream. Whatever you've got, mix it all together, and it's amazing, and it comes onto the table in about 15 minutes, and it's just got such depth of flavor, such richness. To me, that's the epitome of a weeknight dish, something that you can get on the table fast, something that's satisfying, something that you can really enjoy, but it's still real food that you made.
You really did not give your son a chef's knife, a Santoku knife, when he was 2 years of age.
I really did. In fact, we have a video that we produced about this.
J.M., you're beginning to sound a little flaky.
Well, you know, there were moments where I wondered whether this was a good idea. But you know what? He turned to, I gave him a knife. It's a 5-inch knife, and it can be done very safely. And the reason I did this is not because I'm insane, but because to me it's very important that my son, and frankly that all children, be involved in food. That food not just be something that's thrown down in front of them, but that they understand where food comes from, how it gets from the ground to the table, and everybody in between. And so from day one, I've always involved my son in the cooking and in the shopping. And as I say in the book, doing that is not always fun and easy, but what about raising children is always fun and easy.
I sense another book in the future. Yeah, J.M. already called Growing Up Cooking or something.
he's got to earn his keep somehow.
Yeah, whether he'll write it or you'll write it, it's going to be interesting to find out.
Yeah, that's the hot new thing. I mean, even Michael Ruhlman's writing a book about kids cooking. You know?
Right, right. Yeah. And I'm really glad to see it because it is so important that children know about food and understand where it comes from and so that they can make good and healthy and real food choices. And so, for me, it was just kind of a natural part of that, that as soon as I felt he was able, which is probably younger than most people would consider.
Yeah, I would think.
I wanted him to be involved and to be comfortable working in the kitchen with me. And so, it was a very simple thing to do to keep it safe. And the rule was simply that when one hand is on the knife, the other hand has to be off the cutting board and at his side. And this makes it virtually impossible for him to cut himself. It doesn't exactly teach proper knife skills, but that's not the goal here. We're talking about a kid who's two. he's not going to be chopping like a pro. The idea was merely to involve him in the kitchen and to get him feeling comfortable being involved in the kitchen. And, you know, so many kids grow up, like, get away from mommy and daddy while we're cooking, go play, go do something. I wanted to welcome him into the kitchen, and I wanted to show him
he's
that he can do the
kid. Yeah. Yeah, we have photographs all throughout the book of him.
Yes.
Very cute.
Yes, he's quite taken with his fame at the moment.
Oh, all right.
Well,
do you have a website?
I do, jmhirsch, HIRSCH.com.
Okay.
And the book's called High Flavor, Low Labor, Reinventing Night Cooking.
It's a lark, too. It's fun. Good recipes.
I think you'll have fun with the book, and I'm sure you'll have great success cooking the recipes. JM, thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground.
We have.
And everybody's getting healthier, huh?
No excuses for not knowing what to cook tonight.
That's for sure, huh?
And you
least favorite question that you used to present me with every day, what's for dinner?
There we go. Now
we've lots of things for dinner.
Now you ask me what's for dinner.
Exactly.
So it's an about face, if you will, but thank you for joining us at On the Menu Radio this week, and we'll look forward to seeing you same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.